and welcome to the Libby's Podcast, conversations with authors who've been shortlisted for the British Book Awards, lovingly known as the Nibbies. I'm your host and longtime Nibbies fan, Hannah McInnes. These awards celebrate books and everyone who makes them, honouring the entire creative, collaborative journey of a book, from the author's mind to the reader's hand. And that's what we're going to do on this podcast. Chat to some of today's best-loved authors about their books, their writing, what's gone on behind the scenes to get them to where they are, and those lovely moments when they and the books they've created have found their readers.
My name is Catherine Rundle, and I'm the author of a number of children's books, most recently Impossible Creatures. And I also hold a fellowship at Oxford University, and I write nonfiction. I wrote a book about John Donne called Super Infinite, and a book about endangered animals called The Golden Mole.
So set the scene then for the few people listening who have not travelled to the worlds of Impossible Creatures. Take us there and tell us who we meet.
So Impossible Creatures is set on a cluster of islands that are right in the middle of the North Atlantic Ocean, and they're unmappable and you can only get to them by magic. And on those islands, you will find every single creature of myth that mankind has ever encountered. So both the ones we're all very familiar with, like the dragons and the unicorns, but also the mythic creatures that we wrote about in, say, the 12th and 14th and 17th centuries, and that didn't quite pass into modern day consciousness, like carcadans, which are a purplish black man-eating unicorn-like figure, which you get in Persia, or almirages, which are beautiful horned hares with golden horns, or gaggoners, which are birds with iron feet and copper claws and copper beaks, which often prophesy and speak truth. And if you can get to the archipelago, you will find all of those creatures waiting for you in profusion.
I know authors always get asked this, but we always want to know, and especially after that explanation, where the inspiration for these adventures and characters comes from. And do you find it comes to you and forms itself bit by bit when you're going about your life? Or do you sit down and sort of have to close your eyes and make sure that you conjure something up because you have to?
So this one began a long time ago, and I have quite a vivid image of how it began, which is that there's two protagonists, a boy protagonist called Christopher, from whose point of view we see the entire thing. So he's essentially the main character. And then a girl protagonist whose name is Mal Arvorian, and she lives in the archipelago, and she has a flying coat, and the coat allows her to fly only when the wind blows. And I had this image a long time ago, we're talking 10 years ago now, of a girl with a coat that spread out on the wind, just skimming over the tops of her trees with her toes just touching the trees. And that came in part from that feeling when you're a kid at the top of a very blustery hill, when you open your little rain jacket and it feels like you could be lifted off your feet. And then once I had begun, I wrote a very short story called Beware Low-Flying Girls, which has nothing in common with the story at all, except for this girl with a coat that can fly. And then I loved the process of writing Impossible Creatures because it involved so much discovery, so much reading in libraries. I love an archive, and I spend a lot of time in libraries reading, first of all, encyclopedias of mythic creatures, and then manuscripts and things like Pliny, old explorers who would, you know, tell stories of completely real beasts like beavers, and then in the next paragraph there would be dragons. And so trying to build this knowledge base of all the creatures that we have conjured and why we conjured them and what they do for us, that was such a huge, huge, lasting joy.
And I mean, I should also say who the inspiration comes from. It could be just you. And when you hear people like Michael Morpurgo saying of you, there was Tolkien, there is Pullman, and now there's you. And Frank Cultural Boy says it's as enchanting, perilous, and richly imagined as Narnia or Middle Earth. I just wonder,
what that means, whether you were informed by those or whether it is just your unique lands that you take us to.
Well, I think the thing is, I wouldn't move through the world as I do without Narnia and without Tolkien and without Pullman. You know, those texts, I read them when I was quite little. I remember just reading Narnia over and over and over again when I was 8, 9, and 10. And so even if you are actively trying not to step too much in the great shoes that, you know, that the path has been laid out by those writers, you know, they are in our DNA. They are in every inch of your fingernails and hair. You know, Narnia built the kid that I was, I think.
And these are children's books, but you are certainly writing, aren't you, to entertain and engage adults as well as children. Tell us how important that is, bringing them both with you, and how it informs your writing, getting that tone right so that adults are laughing along and also being moved to tears, and that children are with you as well.
Oh, it's something I think about so much. So I want to write a book that is first and foremost for a young person, that will give them the things that they need when they are young, like a sense of huge adventure, of peril, of children being put right at the very edges of their own familiar capacity. But then I also want to write books that cater to what I want in a book now, that acknowledge the nuance and difficult caustic beauty of the human heart, that will acknowledge human spite and human joy. And my reckoning, the reason I adore children's books so much is I think they are the books that can be read by everybody. You know, there are books which you cannot read as a child because they presuppose adult experience, but there are no truly great books. You know, like Gordon said, there are no truly great books for children which are not also great books for adults. And I also wanted to write something that might be something that you could read first now at 10 and then maybe 20 years later, that you could read now at 40 to your 10-year-old child. I wanted it to be a book that all hands could reach for. And for that, you do have to spend a lot of time thinking, is this scene layered enough? Is it rich enough? Does it have enough in it to earn its keep? And if not, it has to go.
Yes, I mean, when you put it like that, you realise you really do have your work cut out, more so than perhaps authors who are just writing for adults. And perhaps all authors writing for children would say they have their work cut out in the way that you explain, because they need it to appeal more widely. And what goes with that is this trust, I suppose, of your younger readers. You use quite complex and advanced language, and you certainly tackle big themes. And that's obviously very important to you.
It is. And I think about it a lot, because there is a risk that if you use a fairly wide vocabulary, you will risk alienating a number of children. But I think that that number is much, much smaller than we think it is. But I do think about it. So, for instance, if I am writing a key tense moment that is absolutely crucial to the plot, I won't at that point use any words that I do not think a child will be deeply familiar with, because I don't want them to have to pause and be brought up by that unfamiliarity. But if we're in a moment of comedy or of journey or of, you know, food, at that, in those moments, I think you can really push at the boundaries of a child's vocabulary, because we know that you cannot understand. You know, there was this fantastic experiment that was done during the war. You can be on the phone to someone and lose something like 40% of the words in that conversation and still understand 100% of the meaning. And so the same is functionally true of a book. You could not understand quite a few of the words in a book. You could just come to them and hop over them and move on. Mm. And you still own the story.
Yeah.
But I also think if we don't give kids a mixture of huge adventure and passion and delight and deliciousness and complex vocabulary, when are they going to learn? And the more complex your vocabulary, the more powerfully you can express yourself, and the more readily you are able to face those who would use an elaborate vocabulary to oppress you. You know, if vocabulary is used by some, I won't mention any names, but, you know, some politicians, to attempt to sort of bamboozle people, we need a deeply educated electorate. And where do you build that? You build that in kids by offering them delicious, bold, ambitiously linguistic stories.
And what about the humour? I listen and read, because I listen to some of the marvellous audiobook as well, and I just think of you, I could be wrong, howling with laughter as you write certain bits. Is that right? Do you?
No, that's so just hugely kind of you. Thank you. I confess, I rarely laugh at my own jokes. Oh. In the writing, but I sometimes laugh at them years later. And then you'll see, you know, my partner once told me I was reading Rooftoppers because Eva Rice is trying to make a wonderful musical adaptation of it. And I laughed out loud at one of the jokes and he was like, that's so dorky.
Oh, well, it is incredibly funny. And then also, of course, as all beautiful books are, it then very, very moving and powerful. And I love the part, you know what, I'm going to take the book down from behind me, because I just, you were talking about some of the themes that you would want to read about. And I just absolutely loved the way you write about friendship. I'm going to find it in yes, but Christopher didn't have the words then to explain what nonetheless he knew, that sometimes if you are among the very lucky, a spark of understanding cuts like lightning across the space between two people. It's a defibrillator for the heart, and it toughens you, it nourishes you, and the word we've chosen for it, which is an insufficient word for being so abruptly upended in a new and finer place, is friendship. I'm not even really asking a question, I suppose, Catherine. I just loved that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I loved writing it. So that would be an example of, I rewrote that little bit. I just wanted this idea of telling children, you know, this is rare. And sometimes it doesn't happen to all of us, but some of us are so lucky and you might be one of them and it is worth hunting for. And so just that paragraph, I rewrote it maybe, 30 times. Some of them, I need to admit, after it was in proof. So the proof has a slightly different writing of it. And my brilliant, brilliant proof editor, Fliss at Bloomsbury Fliss Stevens, she puts up with a lot from me of the book being about to go to print and me saying, could I just rewrite the beginning? And I always end up sending her a sort of magnum of champagne to apologize for being such an absolute unholy terror. So I'm very, very grateful that she allows me to kick at it until it makes the sound I want it to sound.
I want to come back to them, and I know that they adore working with you beyond the magnum of champagne they probably get at the end, which is obviously a great added bonus. But just on these powerful messages, climate is obviously a strong message in so many of your books, and I just wonder why you feel that children's literature in this example and The Golden Mole might be the place to make that message heard.
So I think children right now face a harder world than almost any through history. They have such knowledge, whether they want it or not, of a world on the brink of chaos. And I wanted to write something that would say to them, your action and your focus and your attention and your unwillingness to look away will be so valuable. They will be so cherished. Even if no one sees your work is so worth doing. So in some ways, I wanted to sort of offer them a promise. But then I also think it is such bad manners to offer children a story and give them a lesson. And you do read some books, especially about climate, through which the moral blares like a foghorn. And I think that's just ungenerous to children. I think children need a story, something big and bold and exciting. So I wanted it to be about climate, but about climate in the way that climate is about humanity. And I wanted the book to be about children's humanity, their bravery. You know, I think we consistently underestimate children. I think they might be the most underestimated population. They have such huge profundity of a sense of justice. And I'm not remotely romantic about children. I remember being one. That kids can be real twats. But I just also think, I also think that they have such capacity that we don't always salute. We don't always allow them to bring to the surface. And I guess it's also what you say about the climate thing. That's the other reason I wanted to have jokes, because I think jokes are such a brilliant way to, when you read a book and within a few pages it's got a couple of strong jokes, you feel safely in someone's hands, and you feel like, what is a joke but in some ways an act of cherishing, and in some ways an act of friendship and a kind of spark between you and the reader. So jokes are really, really important to me. I do not want to read a single children's book without jokes.
Even if you don't find yours funny, but we all do. No,
exactly.
Now, I could talk to you about the themes, the book itself, and your interpretations for much, much longer. But in talking about the journey, the moment that it goes from your head and your pen to an experience of collaboration, you've talked about it a little bit. And I actually confess, when I read about the journey from the perspective of the Bloomsbury team, it makes me feel very emotional, their pride working with you and their joy in the whole experience. But I'd love to hear from your perspective, just perhaps some of the standout moments of that experience when it becomes working with the team.
They were totally remarkable. So Bloomsbury's willingness to first of all, at the first stage, you have my brilliant editor, Ellen Holgate, who is currently nominated for Editor of the Year. She is completely spectacular. And one of the ways in which she is spectacular is she doesn't overpraise, so that if ever she says something is good, I will believe her.
Yeah.
It's so important, and it's so easy. I know this from teaching myself at Oxford. The easiest thing you can do is tell someone something is fine. It takes no effort at all. Mm. Praise is free. But the hard intellectual work of finding where something isn't working and putting your razor sharp needle through it, that takes such work. And Ellen is so brilliant about that. This went through many, 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 many drafts. And one of the early ones had a lot more action at the beginning, had about 15,000 words. And Ellen read it and she was like, this 15,000 words, it's all action, but it's no way pushing forward the plot or the emotionality. It was a lot of like running around in woods, people setting traps. And she was like, we don't need that. This is not that book. And I was so grateful to her for that clarity. And I do, just having an editor you trust is a gift, a profound gift. So I have the most brilliant editor. I have a stunning agent, Claire Wilson, who also is fabulous about thinking about plot, about ideas, will, you know, walk through Regent's Park with me for hours talking about stories. And then when it becomes a part of the bigger team, I have the most fantastic publicity director, a woman called Beatrice Cross, who everyone adores, who's also just wonderful company. But she has a kind of a mixture which you don't meet in many people, which is real creativity and fantastic ability to make things happen. A lot of people only have the one or the other. She has both. A fantastic marketing team in Alicia Bonser and Sophie Rosewell. And then just so many people putting together things like the gorgeous art direction and Daniel Mayers doing the cover. And we would sit in meetings. And one of my best memories is of the marketing team being like, okay, so we have a 6-foot dragon.
Which is
going to be touring around the bookshops of England. And because I think it was Alicia who, when she first read the word archipelago, pronounced it archipelago, because she has that thing that we all have, all of us bookie kids, don't hear these words outside out loud. So, you know, you never know. I said the word saccharine until like last year. So we had archipelago, the dragon, who was touring around, who just looked fantastic. B secured the Natural History Museum for the launch. And we all decided together that we would have a dress code. I can't remember who suggested the exact dress code. I think it might have been Ellen or B, which was shimmer like dragon scales, so that everyone turned up just shining. And then just the sense of dedication and of care. I have worked with many publishers, and there are so many who are brilliant, but I don't think I've ever worked with a team this brilliant, this ambitious, who was like, yeah, no, we'll have a huge dragon spillboard right next to the tube station, and we'll have gorgeous advertising on train stations. And they, when they put their minds to it, they can do something completely remarkable. And I am just so, so grateful that they did.
And you've done it before a few times and hugely successfully. Is it always or just increasingly exciting seeing the book out in the wild?
It never, ever gets less thrilling. You sort of expect it would, perhaps, but it really doesn't, because, of course, every time you have this mixture of enormous hope and real terror. Like, it is like jumping off a diving board and having no clue at all if there's going to be water at the bottom. It could just be concrete. And so you just don't know how the book will go. You don't know what people will say. And I've never, ever yet published a book without that terror. And I've spoken to some much older friends who are on their, 100th book. Someone brilliant like Simon Sharma, he was like, no, you remain terrified. That never, ever goes away.
I mean, when you aren't terrified, then you've probably got to stop.
No, right. I assume so. I mean, imagine not being terrified. That must be a strange feeling. I think that I will just aspire to be a little bit less terrified would be good. I wake up sort of throughout the night at 4 a.m. for months before and after it's published. So that would be nice to do away with that. But other than that.
Yes, that I hope will come. I loved hearing that the dragon archipelago's nest in Waterston's Piccadilly for a very long time wasn't intended, but he stayed there a good while.
It was just fabulous. It was in some ways a mistake because I think he was supposed to go in the window but then didn't fit in the window. So instead he had this wonderful perch right by the doors. And the thing that I loved was because I was so lucky when it won Waterston's Book of the Year, I was in Waterston's a lot. And every time I went by, there would be a kid just peering up at him because he's exactly the right height. He's large for a child and eye height for an adult. Fabulous.
That must have been a huge moment winning that.
Oh, it was truly career changing. I mean, Waterston's can do so much so swiftly. And I was absolutely bowled over by it. It was such incredible luck. I remember being told and refusing to believe it until we had it in writing. I was like, you've made a mistake. There's no way this is true. It's someone stuttered on the phone and you didn't hear them. It was a real, real joy. And it did just transform the fate of the book. You know, it was doing well, but Waterston's made it go from selling, I think it was selling 4,000 or 5,000 copies a week to selling 22,000 copies in a week. And that's something no book of mine has ever done. And I was just stunned.
Extraordinary power of Waterston's. And you mentioned your launch party at the Natural History Museum. That must have been quite an extraordinary moment. I did see some photos and just thought that looks utterly surreal, quite frankly.
It was quite surreal. One of the things I loved was that I'm very lucky in that Charles Dance is a friend and he agreed to come and read. My partner works in film, so a few of his more sort of filmy friends were there. So for that reason, it was mentioned in a couple of the papers. But because it was a Natural History Museum, there's an escalator that goes from the top of the earth room to the bottom of the earth room. Crucially for my party, this was static. It was not moving. But there's a photo of me giving a speech on the escalator so that I could see everyone. And the Evening Standard said that I glided into the room on an escalator. I love the idea that I waited for everyone to gather. And then I went to the top and I just levitated down. I mean, madness.
Yeah, well, if anyone was going to do that or fly in on a magic cloak.
Oh, my goodness. That's what we'll do for book, the final book in the series.
Perfect.
Flying.
I will investigate how you might be able to do that. And Catherine, what about readers, meeting your readers? Because of course there were these years where authors couldn't meet their readers in real life. And I think that must have been so hard. What's it like meeting the readers, particularly of this book and some of the interactions you've had with them?
It has been, hands down, without doubt, my favourite book of my entire career to meet the readers of, because a lot of them bought it quite soon, and I did a big tour that lasted months. So by the end, a lot of them had read it, and they would bring me their own impossible creatures. They would bring me drawings. I got a couple of dragon models. I got knitted impossible creatures. The glory of that. But my favourite thing was when you would meet kids, anything from about 8, but even quite old kids, 12, who would say to me, I think maybe I had more than a dozen of these wonderful kids saying, so I know it's not real. It's fictional, because it says at the beginning, but I just wanted to check. Is it real? And that gave me such joy. The idea that maybe there's an archipelago, maybe you can get there. Yeah. I just love it.
I feel like I could ask you that, but you know, I'm perhaps not representative of many adults. I still can't call myself an adult, but I feel like I could ask you that very happily. And I mean, you won a Nibby last year for Super Infinite, and no one will ever forget your wonderful speech. But what does it mean to be shortlisted for a Nibby?
Oh, it is such a huge privilege, truly, because, you know, it means that you end up in a room with people who make books possible. So it's not just the writers, it's also the booksellers, the agents, the editors, the people who make the books reach people's attention, the marketing, the publicity. And I think it is possible often to forget that, that, you know, books are not written alone, that you write them in these groups of brilliant creative people. And so, you know, winning that Nibby last year was truly one of the most gorgeous and genuinely surprising things that had ever happened to me. I was so thrilled. The reason for that, I recited poetry instead of a speech, was because I genuinely was so sure there were so many brilliant books on that list. I was sure I wouldn't win, so I didn't write a speech, so I didn't have one. So I recited John Donne. It's what I do under pressure.
I could go on talking to you for so much longer, but I can't, because our time has come to an end. Thank you very, very much. And I will see you on May the 13th.
I can't wait. Fabulous.
If you enjoyed today's podcast, make sure to subscribe to the series to hear more conversations with Nibby's authors. And we'd love it if you'd rate it and leave us a review. Do visit thebookseller.com/British-book-awards to find out more about the industry's biggest celebration of books and all who make them. This podcast was produced by Heavy Entertainment.